Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. Good afternoon, folks. Welcome back once again, and happy Tuesday. It is, in fact, time for the Torah Teachers Roundtable. Got to admit, I've been looking forward to this show and probably the next one or maybe two that will follow, because we have now entered into the part of the book of Ezekiel that I think is certainly one of several, but arguably, perhaps one of the very meatiest in the whole, in the book of Ezekiel for sure, maybe in the scriptures, and especially apropos right now, although it's probably been apropos for about 17 centuries. But given what's coming and where we are, this is one that I encourage people to pay attention to, take a listen to, listen more than once if you need to. Certainly read the chapters here with us and think about what's being spoken about, talked about, and warned about. So with that, what we'll do is a quick recap. We actually read the first few verses of chapter 8 of Ezekiel last time. I won't reread that. I will go to MP in just a second. He had some comments he wanted to make on it, but we've basically discussed about up through verse 10. This is where it begins by saying, came to pass in the sixth year, sixth month, fifth day of the month, the author, the prophet, is sitting, and he's sitting with the elders of Judah, and the hand of Elohim, of Yahuwah, fell upon him there. And he describes what he saw, and then he says, "Hey, son of man, lift up your eyes now towards the north." So I looked to the north, and there, north of the altar gate, was this image of jealousy in the entrance. And here follows the motif, the theme that's going to run through literally the next chapter and a little bit beyond. He's going to be asked over and over again, "Hey, do you see the kind of abominations? Look at this nasty, awful, evil stuff that they are doing." And we'll talk in specific about some of those nasty, evil things. But do you see these great abominations that are being done that the house of Israel commits here, to make me go far away from my sanctuary? Now turn again, you'll see even greater abominations. So this is where we're at, and the kinds of things we're going to be talking about first today. And I'll say it up front, and I'm sure it'll get repeated, that there are things in here that if we look at them and honestly observe what he's talking about, hey, we've heard about them. They are they're whore church traditions, and I'll say it that way explicitly. These are abominations that the creator of the universe says he hates, that the whore church was doing right in his sanctuary, and it really, let me put it as a gross understatement, it really irritated him, something fierce. So let's go to you, MP. Take it away. And good afternoon, right. Too.
Thank you. Real briefly, you hearing me?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh.
Loud and clear.
Okay, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure. Okay, so basically, what we're seeing here is the prophecy that came to him just after he came out of his 430 days of lying on his sides. Okay, 390 days on one side and then 40 days on the other, and those two things were prophetic of how long portions of Israel were going to be in captivity. Anyway, in verse 1, Yechezkel sits in his house in Babylon on 5 Tishrei, that's the fifth day of the sixth month, receiving the elders of Yehuda when the hand of Yah came on him like a Mormon missionary at an Amway convention. I mean, we're talking relentless. Now, it is very likely that Yechezkel was the senior prophet and the high priest of Israel in Babylon. So the civic leaders and the elders of the tribes would very likely have had at least monthly meetings with him, and Azamra seems to think it was daily. What came of the hand of Yah falling on him is that Yehezkel describes in verses 2 through 4, while in the very presence of Yah. I wonder, did the elders and the priests see what Zeke saw, or how long a time transpired for the elders and the priests while Ezekiel experienced the vision? Was it momentary in the physical, or was there a period of time between the howdy and the vision completeness? Okay, did it take a long time to see if, as it would take Zeke to experience and describe it? All good questions. Since I have never experienced a prophetic vision, I have no idea. But Azamra has this on verses 1 through 3. They say, Ezekiel, and this is pretty lengthy, Ezekiel was a spiritual leader and head of the Sanhedrin of the Judean exiles in Babylon, and thus the elders of the people came to sit before him daily. I told you that's what they said. It was in this very their very presence, that Hashem's hand of prophecy overwhelmed him, and in his vision he saw himself being taken by the locks of his head and carried by the ruach, the wind or spirit, to the northern gate of the temple of Jerusalem. Now, obviously, he's not actually physically there, but he is there spiritually. The spirit has taken him there in the spirit. This was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy, verses 1 through 3. The image of jealousy was the idolatrous image originally made by King Menashe. When Menashe repented, he cast it out of Jerusalem, but did not destroy it. And his son, King Ammon, restored it. Despite the Torah revival in the reign of Ammon's son, King Josiah, Yoshiahu, it appears that the wicked kings who followed him again restored this image. It must be understood that such an image was not merely a fancy representation dreamed up by some artist, which people then proceeded to worship for no reason. King Menashe was an outstanding Torah scholar, and without doubt found the deepest realization or rationalizations for the image that he set up. Rabbi Nachman teaches that God intentionally brought it about that the writings of the ancients justifying their idolatry should be lost, since later generations, lacking the wisdom to refute them, would otherwise be in dire peril of succumbing to their influence. That according to Likutei Mahoran 2:32.
Okay, MP, let's pause right there.
Go ahead.
Let's pause right there, because like I said, I was going to try to do some more interrupting today, and we'll have as much discussion as we can, because that's an important point, and it's one that I don't want to get glossed over. The writings that justified these abominations were lost. I'm going to say, excuse me, they're in the basement of the Vatican. So is a whole lot of other crap, and I'm going to use that word because it's the politest term, that basically justifies all their abominations. Oh, we'll Christianize anything. As we go through the list of abominations, we're going to see that's precisely what's been done. And I guarantee you, you can get online, you can do a quick search with Wikipedia or any of a bunch of other places. You can go to the various catechisms, you can go to, you name it, the Whore Church Archives, and they're going to tell you all kinds of reasons why bunnies and eggs and Christmas trees, and you name it, if it's pagan, it's in there, and it's perfectly fine. God loves it, He knows my heart. How many times have we heard this? No, those writings, you know, as far as the Jewish sages are concerned, they may have been lost, but as far as the rest of us are concerned, come on, we've been hearing them in Sun God Day school since we were little tykes. Go ahead.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. and I'll be getting into that a little bit later here, too. So the Midrash Rabbah Devarim states that Menashe's image had four faces, corresponding to the four chayot of the divine chariot. Okay, it seems that Menashe had deep knowledge of what Ezekiel was later to see in this vision, okay, in Ezekiel chapter 1. But Menashe turned the angels into gods, violating the second commandment by representing them with physical images. Okay, so that was where Menashe went wrong. He started changing these things into images and putting them up to be worshipped. And that was the problem with Menashe. That's why he had to be removed and replaced, which he was by, I believe it was Yoshiahu. Now, in verse 2, Zeke beheld a likeness as the appearance of fire. That needs to be broken down a bit. A likeness is not a thing it is like. The word likeness is translated from the Hebrew 1823 demut, which means a resemblance, which strongly implies not exactly the same thing. I think that means that Zeke didn't have the words to perfectly describe it, so he gave it his best shot. I think he would say that it was too wonderful for me to express, but I'll try. Okay? So human language just can't express its wonderfulness. To give you an idea, as the appearance of fire is translated from a single hyphenated word, chemara esh, the chaf prefix means as or like, and the word mare means to expand or enlarge. So as expanding, okay, the very next Hebrew word is mamara, literally from expansion or enlargement. So Yehezkel saw what appeared to be fire, more or less replacing his, that is the image's, legs and feet. So his legs and feet were like fire, while what was above appeared like fire, both the color of amber. Now amber, again, from the Hebrew 28:30 is chashmal, which Brown Driver Briggs says is of uncertain origin. Nearest Hebrew I could find was in EDBH was to silence or to demand obedience, which obedience is probably what I would do if I saw and heard something like this myself. Now, it does not say that this was amber, but that it was had the color of amber. TSK has an interesting, if not exactly salient, comment on amber. They say that amber is a hard, inflammable, bituminous substance. In other words, it's like coal, of a beautiful yellow color. Very transparent and susceptible to an exquisite polish. When rubbed, it is highly endowed with electricity. This is interesting. A name which the moderns have formed from its Greek name, electron. But as amber becomes dim as soon as it feels the fire and is speedily consumed, it is probable that the original chashmal derives from the nahash, the copper, the color of the serpents in Egypt. And melala, gold, was a mixed metal, similar to that which the Greeks called helectron, or electron, okay, electrical, as the LXX and the Vulgate render from its resemblance to amber in color. So this thing appeared, from the aspect of the viewer, Yehezkel, to be an amber-colored fire whose flow extended both upward and downward from its center, kind of like gas burners in a space heater or in an oven. You've seen where the gas comes out the sides, you know, and it's a longer than it is wide. That's exactly what we're talking about here, except that the fire is like amber. And that's what I got through verse 2. I got a lot more here, but I'm going to let it go for now.
Okay. Ken, do you have anything you want to add, or should we continue on and let's read about some of the abominations that he's talking about here?
Yeah, let's read on. I know I commented up, I think, through verse 10, so I would like to get up at least a little bit up into what is seen within the house.
Exactly, because this is, again, it's so vital and it is so it's so topical, and we simply can't afford to miss it. Mm-hmm. So he brought me to the door of court. I'm going to just summarize the next couple verses because, we're going to see greater abominations. So I looked, there was a hole in the wall, and he said, hey, why don't you dig in there? So I dug, and there was a door, and he said to me, go in, here we go, and see the wicked abominations, the Hebrew word is toiba, or plural, which they are doing there. So over and over again, this motif, look at all the nasty, evil, wicked stuff that just really torques me off that they're doing here. So I went in and saw, and there, says verse 10, every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts, and all the idols of Beit Israel, of the house of Israel, portrayed all around on the walls. And there stood before them 70 men of the elders of the Beit Israel, house of Israel. And in their midst stood Yaazaniah, the son of Shaphan. Each man had a censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. So these are really wonderful priest types, right? Doing their jobs, or are they? Then he said to me, son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the room of his idols? For they say, Yahuwah doesn't see us. Yahuwah has forsaken the land. And I'll read one more verse. We'll go to Ken this time. And he says, hey, turn again, son of man, and you will see the greater abominations that they are doing. Greater and greater and greater. Go ahead, Ken.
Let me, I know I did comment up to verse to chapter or verse 10, sorry, but I did want to comment on that again a little bit in an expanded mode here, just because of the fact that what's being seen is within this house, and it's all around the walls. Now, keep in mind too that the righteous had to seek and search through a hidden area in order to reach the wickedness. Okay, this is how the wicked are. You know, they hide, and where do they hide? They often hide in the dark. And I believe when he said dark, he's really speaking of not just dark as in what we see with our own eyes, but dark as in where there is no light in terms of his light, you know, where there is wickedness, because this is true wickedness, where Yah's word, Yah's ways are put away completely, and they are doing whatever their imagination can think of. And this is where I think it gets so abominable, as it said. So we have all these idols there, and we have who is it? The ancients, which the ancients, you know, this 70 elders, it's kind of likened to the 70 elders, as we recall back with Moshe. Remember, Moshe chose 70 elders to help rule the people. Okay. And again, I feel like they're mixing the ways of Yah with the ways of their own hearts. They're using incense. I'm guessing this is the temple prescribed incense, unfortunately, which would be an even greater abomination amongst idols and other pagan worship. Ezekiel then finds out that they think Yah has abandoned them, and thus they are doing, again, like I said, whatever their imagination desires, which is why this appears to be the worst kind of mixing within the temple imaginable. Okay. I just wanted to throw that emphasis in there, because this is about where Mark Petrone was in terms of about to explain what he and others see in this house and just how bad it is. So let me stop there and see if MP can catch up a bit. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to catch up real quick. I'm just going to jump ahead. Kind of run through 9 through 12. Now, please remember that the he in chapter 9, in verse 9 rather, and he said unto me, go in and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. Okay, that he refers back to verse 1's Adonaiah, who says, bo yireh, go see what's going on in there. Yechezkel immediately obeys, and what to his wondering I should appear, but all kinds of abominable creatures and idols of Jeroboam's Israel etched or painted on the walls of the entry chamber, hall of the Kodesh Kadeshim, at the very vestibule. TSK has a salient comment on this. They say these images portrayed on the wall were no doubt the objects of Egyptian idolatry, the ox, ape, crocodile, ibis, beetle, and etc., as we find those idols were painted on the walls of the tombs of the kings and nobles. Since Egypt was one of Israel's closer allies, and I'm talking about northern kingdom of Israel, closer allies, that's a good possibility. But that's not all. There's more. In verse 11, there stood before all of these images of wicked beasts, 70 men, Zachanim, elders of the whole house of Israel, like in the wilderness adventure with Moshe, Aharon, and the rest. Not just the priests, but the elders of the whole house of Israel, each with smoking censers in their midst, and their hands, and a thick cloud of smoke blurring their vision and their senses. I would not be surprised to find that the incense was actually an opiate of some kind, maybe even an edible. Well, it would be today, anyway. Here's a Zamra on the 70. They say, and 70 men from among the elders of the house of Israel, and Ya'azanyahu, the son of Shaphan, in their midst, in verse 11. He was an important figure, and his generation learned from him, and this is why God was angry with him, according to Rashi. As we follow Ezekiel on his virtual tour of the abominations practiced by the most respectable people in the holiest of places, we can but imagine the kinds of abominations reportedly practiced by some of the most prominent public figures of our times in the secret chambers of places like the Vatican, Bohemian Grove in Northern California, and many others that the wider public knows nothing about.
Like the White House, for example. Wait. And we've been seeing these stories, hearing these stories for years, including all the way back especially to the Clinton regime.
Absolutely. And I'm going to reference one of them right here. Did you know that the only modern president of the United States, up to and including Obama, I haven't heard about Trump, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn that he didn't either, to not go up to the presidential initiation of Bohemian Grove was Reagan. Reagan wasn't there after he was elected president. He may have been there at some time before. I remember seeing a picture of him there one time. But anyway, Alex Jones did an expose on that in the late 90s or the early 2000s, if memory serves. Nixon actually said it was the faggiest GD thing he'd ever seen. I have no doubt that Sleepy Joe went, though I don't think that he'll remember it. If I'm right about Trump and he refused to go to Bohemian Grove, it could be the reason for all the vitriol against him from both major parties.
Well,
by the way,
wait a second.
Reagan didn't go, and Reagan was assassinated.
Do you remember, MP, that it was, I think it was the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. I could be wrong. I don't have it sitting here. I didn't know you were going to mention this. But where he said, essentially, the problem with Trump was he didn't go through the initiation. He came right out and said it on one of the Sunday morning TV shows.
And there you go. That's the initiation for the president, is to go to Bohemian Grove and worship the idol there. That's a great big giant owl. It's absolutely amazing. It's absolutely amazing what goes on there. He didn't go, and 6 weeks after he took the oath of office, he was shot in the chest.
All right. Okay? Well, let me caution us about one thing. It's not that there are these things that are going on in secret. There are. But I'm going to suggest as we go through here, we're going to find that, honestly, that's the least of it. Yes, there's nasty stuff in secret. Yes, it's been pushed. But the point is, the stuff that's going on that's being described here as greater and greater abominations is not the least bit secret. And as a matter of fact, I guess I wouldn't be surprised if not every single listener hasn't seen or heard about some of these kind of things, and we'll go through it.
Amen. Well, let me cover through verse 12, and then I'll give it up. In verse 12, the Elohim of Israel, he's been speaking this whole time, okay, asked Zeke, did you see all of that? Every man in his chambers of his imagery? That speaks to me of the denial that Yah even exists among the priests and prophets of early 6th century BCE Israel. They won't listen to the true prophet of Yah because he won't tickle their ears with falsehood. They think that Yah has given up on the earth in general, and Yehuda and Israel in particular. They think that they and the world are on their own. So they may as well do what feels good, and to hell with what is good. That sounds a lot like the world, especially the United States, today, doesn't it? Awaken your people, those who are actually after your ways, Abba, and have us pray for and work toward a revival to you. That's a prayer that I lay out all the time. Without that, this world is doomed to great tribulation, and that right soon. I'm certain of it. I see it coming. I see it coming. It's not that far off. Okay, so we got an election coming up that may slow it down a little bit, but probably not. That's what I got through verse 12.
Okay, Ken, what do you got?
Just to tie in with what MP's saying here, you know, regarding the 70 elders, remember, they actually represent all the tribes, okay? That's what the 70 elders were all about, to represent everyone, and that they were the heads.
Okay, the tail of the hour. I'm hungry, so we're gonna pick it up when we get back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday, either lost or not, because all my life I've
dum dooby doo dum dum. Come a come a dum dooby doo dum dum. Come a come a dum dooby doo dum dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. Let's say that I'm by the Lord. The 16 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new. Challenge did it in motion.
All right, we are back. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. We're talking about one of the most meat-filled prophetic understandings of where we are today and where they were then, too. But it's interesting, isn't it, how Solomon was right. There's nothing new under the sun, and this is a really good example of that. Anyway, of in the entire book of Ezekiel and perhaps in all of prophecy, it's a dramatic one. So with that, let's go back to Ken. We interrupted him at the bottom of the hour.
Yeah, I did want to negate, if I said the word chiefs, I should have said chiefs, because these are actually just simply spiritual leaders and or judges, okay? But they do, like from the times of Moshe, those 70 that were chosen, that were filled with Yah's spirit, you know, their role was to assist Moshe in or judging or really assisting. Absolutely. All the tribes. I'm sorry. Go ahead, MP.
Oh no, I'm agreeing with you. The 70 elders were of their particular tribes, and they took care of all the families underneath them. They were the ones that they went to, and if anything was too tough for them, then they took that to Moshe.
Right. Amen. So you can see then how just like in that day, this day, why would there be elders? Would most likely be the same exact reasoning. They would be ones who would lead the people. And here you can see how the people are being led by falsehoods.
That's
by a different walk. I mean, isn't that like today so much? I mean, it's kind of like our people today are really being led by the mass media, and who owns the mass media would be such likened elders, you could say. Only these would be extremely rich elders, those who were probably the, you know, cream, you know, the 0.001% richest of all the world. It would be those elders who are trying to, you know, capture the whole world under their scope and under their realm within their hands. And they're getting this false word out through the media. And it's almost like being brainwashed. It's, oh, here's what we should do. Here's what's best for you. You know, and our people are listening. That's the scary part. They're listening today just like they were listening in those days. And look, we're going to find out. There was not this great mass of people who disagreed with those elders. There's not. It's a very small amount. That's what's really sad about this moment in time. Very sad. Anyway, yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there about the 70 elders. So, maybe we can read on a little bit.
Okay. MP, you want to comment or are you ready?
Yeah, I'd like to comment. I haven't. I'm right here, beginning around chapter 13. Yah speaks once again to Yechezkel, telling him to look another direction for even worse abominations than the 70 elders of Israel bowing to Baal at Al in the very sanctuary of Yah. In verse 14, Yechezkel saw women at the north gate weeping for Tammuz. The name is from the Hebrew Tamaz, means to light a fire. And EDBH has an idol whose worship included setting a large fire. Easton's Bible Dictionary says, a corruption of Dumuzi, the Akkadian sun god, the Adonis of the Greeks, the husband of the goddess Ishtar. In the Chaldean calendar, there was a month set apart in honor of this god, the month of June to July, the beginning of the summer solstice, and it's called Tammuz, believe it or not. At this festival, which lasted 6 days, the worshippers with loud lamentations bewailed the funeral of the god. They sat weeping for Tammuz. Okay? Stones Tanakh has this. The Tammuz was an idol made in such a way as to create the optical illusion that it was crying as if begging for offerings. That according to Rashi. Azamra has this on verse 14. And behold, there sat women making the Tammuz weep in verse 14. This was a certain metal statue that they used to heat up from within, and its eyes were made of lead, which began to melt because of the heat of the furnace. It looked as if the statue was weeping, and the women would say, "He is asking for a sacrifice," according to Rashi. Now, were these women prophetesses? Were they nuns? The answer is yes, I think. But in verse 15, Yah says, "Zeke, you ain't seen nothing yet." This was, remember, in the very sanctuary of the temple, albeit at the northern gate, which, as we discussed before, was what the priest offering in the priest offering in the burnt offering to Yah would be looking at as he offered the kaporet, whose blood was to be placed on the incense altar early on Yom HaKippurim. In Exodus, chapter 30, in verses 1 and then 8 through 10, says this, "And thou shalt make an altar of burnt incense upon, of shittim wood shalt thou make it, and when Aharon lighteth the lamps at even, he shall burn incense upon it, the perpetual incense before Yah throughout your generations. Ye shall offer no strange incense thereon, nor burnt sacrifice, nor meat offering, neither shall ye pour drinks, a drink offering thereon. And Aharon shall make an atonement upon the horns of it once in a year with the blood of the sin offering for atonements. Once in a year shall he make atonement upon it throughout your generations. It is most holy unto Yah." By Yechezkel's time, the 25 officiating priests in the temple service were all idolaters, facing the idol of Tammuz as they sacrificed the kaporet. Is there a connection to the Roman Catholic priests offering the host to the man nailed to the cross that they face? I think. That's what I got through verse 14.
Okay, MP, and honestly, I don't expect that some of the Jewish sages and scholars are going to get this right, honestly, because it sounds too negative against Christianity, and they got plenty of things already. But the truth of the matter is, we have to just come right out and say it here. Tammuz and the 40 days of weeping for Tammuz and the boar that killed him and all of the pagan... Yep. Lore associated with this are right out of Sun God Day and Ishtar and you name it. Let me just read you one of a couple of things people can find relatively easy. The god of springtime, Tammuz, an ancient Sumer and Babylonia, became very popular Syria and Phoenicia as Adonai, my Lord, and Adonis in various Hellenistic lands. According to the myths, Tammuz was killed every year by a wild boar, but was rescued from the netherworld by Easter, Ishtar, who brought him back to life and assured a new springtime. Thus, the natural cycle was symbolized, all of this. And, of course, we celebrate with bunny and eggs. And it goes on. But guess where this wonderful custom of the Ishtar ham comes from? Got to kill the boar that killed Tammuz before Ishtar brought him back to life. On Ishtar Sun God Day. In other words, again, as we go through this, we're going to see time after time, place after place, the things that people think, oh, are wonderful, warm, fuzzy traditions, God knows my heart, are as pagan as hell. And it really is that simple. The pagan Easter is more often associated, this is another story, with Ashtaroth, Esther, Easter, the Anglo-Saxon goddess of spring, Semiramis, and Nimrod. Okay, all these things are connected in there, and has to do with the death of Nimrod, variations on the theme, how Semiramis told them that Nimrod had become the sun god Baal. That's why we have sunrise services, taking advantage of her death. his death, she was proclaimed a goddess and descended from the moon in an egg that dropped into the Euphrates on the first full moon after the spring equinox. Does any of this start to sound vaguely familiar? Semiramis became known as Ishtar, a.k.a. Easter. Her moon egg became Ishtar's egg. Then she became pregnant by the rays of Baal, and the son she bore, Tammuz, was killed by a wild boar as he was hunting. Semiramis proclaimed the god Tammuz had now ascended to Baal as well. But in mourning for Tammuz, people were to eat no meat for 40 days. Then they celebrated the resurrection of Tammuz on Ishtar Sun God Day by killing and eating a pig and having some bunnies and eggs. Go ahead, Ken.
Wow.
By the way, did we read up to verse 12? Is that what we read up to?
Greater and greater abominations. We read through weeping for Tammuz, verse 14 and 15. But don't worry, we're going to see greater abominations repeated over and over again.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm going to wait till we get at least about verse 16 before I comment a bit more. So go ahead if y'all want to catch up a little bit.
Okay, you had anything else you want to add on the wonderful pagan Ishtar Sun God Day and Easter ham traditions, MP?
No, not at all. I mean, you've pretty much covered it. It's absolutely a pagan holiday.
Well, you know, and there's a little bit of Catholic tradition that comes in here too. Might as well mention this, because one of the things that people may remember was during the time of the the time when they persecuted folks. Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 because he was a Jew. What am I trying to remember of? The Pope, the current Pope Satan,
anyway.
he was the head of the Catholic, fill in the blank, crossword puzzle. Oh, I'm having a Biden moment here. It'll come to me.
You're talking about Inquisition?
Inquisition, thank you. There's the word. The Inquisition. But the way that you proved that you were not one of those Bible-observing, Torah-obedient Jews, and therefore Judaizing, was somebody came around on Ishtar Sun God Day, hey, are you celebrating with the, oh yeah, look here, see this pig? This is the Ishtar ham. Let me, good stuff. Eat some of this pig. Prove that I'm not Bible and Torah-obedient. So there have been a number of things throughout history that basically make this point. And again, the metaphor here, the recurring theme, look over here, see greater abominations. No wonder he was some kind of PO'd. And guess what, folks? This is the thing I think absolutely ought to leap off the pages here. Ain't nothing changed. Again, nothing new under the sun. This is the same damnable Ishtar sun god crap. That's being, and to think about it, this is the thing that always irritates me around the springtime. You want to take and you want to say, let's rub his nose in it. Let's say, hey, what's the most important event in all of human history? Let's rename it after a pagan sun goddess and celebrate it by eating that which he calls an abomination and doing that which he says really, really pisses him off. And guess what? We're going to see more in just a few minutes. People ought to be upset because he was, and to rename the most important feast and an event, the resurrection of the risen Mashiach, in honor of a pagan sun goddess, has got to be about the greatest abomination I can think of that a whore church commits.
Amen, and it does.
No.
And I was raised in that one, man. My parents were Catholic. They baptized me on the 40th day, I think. And I went to Catholic grade school and got tired of it. And I decided I wanted to go to public school after that. And that started in the 8th grade. And I got away from that and found Messiah when I was in my teens. This is just. Everything that I was raised in was absolute lie. Absolute lie. And, the Easter ham. Listen to this. I had a friend named Mickey Berkowitz, all right? Obviously a Jewish kid, right? And he's over at my house on Easter Sunday, and my mother has a ham in the oven, right? And she says, hey, Mickey, I realize that, you know, you're Jewish and all that, but we're going to have ham for dinner, but you're welcome to stay if you'd like. And he walked over to the oven where the ham was cooking, and he made a sign of the Star of David, right? And he said, "It's fish." And he stayed. He was not an observant Jew.
That's why some of us refer to both the whore church and the whore synagogue, MP, because there's a lot of that goes on in both houses that are still in exile, and I would argue that's why both houses are still in exile.
Exactly. Exactly right. So anyway, I've gone through verse 14. If Ken would, if you'd like to make sure we're through 15 and 16.
Let me add one more thing, then we'll go to Ken, if I may. And that is, if it sounds like I'm hard on these pagan traditions, and it sounds like, oh, gee, Mark is really, really, he's going over the top. He's off the deep end about all this paganism. Well, God knows my heart. He didn't like that. You know what, folks? If you think I'm angry, just wait till you read the next chapter. We're going to talk about what Yah does to all those people who did these things. And that ought to cause some genuine consternation. That's my tease for what's coming. Go ahead, Ken.
No, I think the only other thing I was going to add was I do recall seeing this on a lot of portrayals of our Messiah on the stake was a little writing above him, and it was three letters. And I recall when you look at those three letters, it's the first letter of the three major gods in that day. Horus. I can't remember all three of them.
Oh,
IHS. Y'all remember the three letters I'm speaking of?
IHS. Is that
it? I'm sorry.
IHS?
Yes, that's it. IHS. Yes. And it that was representative of three gods.
Yeah. Can't remember who the S was.
Well, here's the funny part, guys. There's some great teachings. You'll find this online. And if you read through the translations and they get it wrong, and because we don't understand the Hebrew and they twist just a little bit of it, there was a sign that Pilate put out there, and it was written in multiple languages, among them Hebrew. And what you have to understand is that in the Hebrew was the thing that the rabbis objected to, the so-called high priest and the others really upset him, because what he wrote, what Pilate wrote in order to be put by Yahushua was Yahushua Hanatzri Vemelek Ha Yehudim in the Hebrew. So Yahushua, his name, Hanatzri, the Nazarite, Vemelek, and King Ha Yehudim of the Yehudim, the Jews, that tribe. And of course, if you looked at it the way the rabbis looked at it, that would read YHVH. So, and they said, oh, you can't say that. And what they're missing, and what of course the Roman pagan tradition of putting different gods entirely in there, name it after a pagan fertility god misses, is that Pilate ordered a sign put on there that literally said YHVH Yod Hey Vav Hey, and that just tore him a new one. Go ahead, MP.
Okay, yeah, you were talking about IHS, I'm pretty sure. And the three letters that are put up, Ishtar, Horus, and Semiramis. IHS is in the middle of the, I can't remember what the thing is called now, where in a lot of Catholic churches, a monstrance is what it's called. It's a big gold thing, and in the middle of it is a great big white, like a host that you take in communion, okay, and it's like 4 inches in diameter, and it has IHS stamped on it as well, and it means Isis, Horus, Semiramis, but they say it means in his service.
Yeah.
Okay, so as to
it's just not clean. It's just not the right he that we're talking about is the trouble.
That's it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, if we're ready, let's read another few verses through the end of the chapter. And we can certainly, I think what we're going to want to do as we go on is to head back and review some of these things. But I'll contend that the basic point is made. He is going to continue to bring it home. We're going to see that as we continue here. So he says, you'll see greater abominations. Keep looking here, keep looking there. So he brought me into the inner court of Yahuwah's house, Beit Yahuwah, there at the door of the temple of Yahuwah, not the Lord, remember, because that's one of the things they did, get rid of his name so that it can be IHS and Ashtar and Ishtar and Ashtaroth and you name it. His name does matter.
Yep.
So he brought me into the inner court of the temple of Yahuwah, between the porch and the altar. There were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of Yahuwah and their faces toward the east. Oh, guess what they were doing, folks? Listen carefully. They were having a sunrise service, and they were worshiping the sun toward the east. And he said to me, this is Yah
right.
saying, hey, have you seen this, O son of man? Is this a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with Hamas. So by the way, one of the things that they used to do, they still do it. Remember, some of the churches back east will still to this day only dye eggs red. Because remember what happened in springtime? All the babies that were born as a result of the pagan sacrifices needed to be sacrificed themselves, going to dye the bunnies and the eggs red in their blood. So is this a trivial thing that they're doing? They have filled the land with Hamas, with violence, kind of almost like what the Biden regime is doing. They have returned to provoke me to anger. And we'll come back to this because I think we'll have some discussion, but it says, indeed, they put the branch to their nose. So, this is the last verse. We'll go to UMP first. We got about 3 minutes till the break at this point. Therefore, he says, I will also act in fury. And we're going to continue this after the top of the hour. I will act in fury, he says. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. Though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them. All right, go ahead, MP.
Amen. Okay, I'm going to get cut off here, so let me go ahead. In 15:16. Yah says, in a marked paraphrase, you ain't seen nothing yet. Look over there. He is now pointing Yehezkel towards the east gate, perhaps the Mount of Olives, where Yeshua would weep 600 years later as he was arrested by the temple guard and taken before Pilate, who washed his hands of the whole affair and told the successors of Yehezkel's priests, you have a guard, you see to it. Okay, in Yochanan chapter 19, verses 13 through 19, I'm going to get cut off before I'm done, but it says this, when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Yeshua forth and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbata. And it was the separation of the preparation of the Passover, and about the sixth hour, and he said unto the Jews, the Yehudim, behold your king. But they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him, please. Pilate saith unto him, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered, and they said, we have no king but Caesar. Then delivered he him therefore unto them to be crucified. And they took Yeshua and led him away. And he, bearing his cross, went forth into a place called Skull Place, which is called in the Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him and two other with him, one on either side, and Yeshua in the midst. And Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. And the writing was, Yeshua of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Which, by the way, in Hebrew is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, if you just read the first letters, okay? Yeshua HaNotzre V'Melech HaYehudim, okay? Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. That's what he put on the sign. And that's what he was crucified under. And all the people looked up there and they said, wait, no, don't say that he, too late, man. Too late, he told the Sanhedrin. They said, don't do that, say that he said that. I said, nope, what I have written, I have written. Pilate knew who was being crucified. Okay? He knew it. And I'm amazed, oh, we got 30 seconds yet. Okay. Now, did you notice that the priests in the temple in Yehezkel 8 were facing the east gate towards what would be called Olivet, Calvary, around the early first century CE? There are numerous reasons that people called the Mount of Olives the Skull Place.
Sometimes I lay under the moon.
All right, we are at the break.
And then God, I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord turns around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay. One day, one day, one day. Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true.
I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
All right, we are back, folks. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable. We're talking today about one of the most, I would say, either enlightening or ought to be concerning for those that haven't yet figured out that the creator of the universe really does hate the stuff he calls abomination and kept saying over and over and over again throughout the Torah and then throughout the prophets, and now he's telling us again that he hates. And we're seeing it, and yet people continue to do it and think, oh, he knows my heart. The answer is, yeah, he does. We talked about this in Jeremiah. It's desperately wicked, deceitful above all. And we're still,
right.
We've inherited these lies. All right, we went from MP at the break. Let's let him finish up.
Okay. Now, yeah, I was just talking about the Yeshua of Nazareth, the king of the Jews, is Pilate. Telling him that that's what he wrote, that and it said Yud Hey Vav Hey, and he's writing it in a straight line down. Yeshua HaNotzri Ben Melech HaYehudim. Okay, so did you notice that the priests in the temple in Yechezkel 8 were facing the east gate toward what would be called Olivet, Calvary, around the early first century CE? That's what they would be calling it. There are numerous reasons that people called the Mount of Olives the skull place, and here are two. One, it was a spot where skulls were to be found lying about and probably, therefore, a public place of execution. This tradition apparently originates with Jerome. He's a Roman Catholic saint, 346 to 420 A.D., who refers down below, and I'll get to it in a minute, to condemn it, who refers to condemn it and says that outside the city and without the gate, there are places wherein the heads of condemned criminals were cut off and which have obtained the name of Calvary, that is, of the beheaded. This view has been adopted by several later writers. Against it may be urged that there is no shadow of evidence that there was any special place for Jewish executions in the first century, and that if there were, the corpses would have been allowed burial in conformity with Jewish law, Deuteronomy 21:23, and with normal custom. And here's what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 21 and verses 22 and 23. It says this: and if a man have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be put to death, and thou hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day. For he is that is hanged is accursed of God, that thy land may not be defiled, which Yah Elohecha giveth thee an inheritance. Okay? That's in Deuteronomy chapter 21. Then, number two. There were two reasons, right? Here's the second one. The name is due to an ancient pre-Christian tradition that the skull of Adam was found there. The first mention of this was by Origen in 185 to 253 A.D. is when he lived, who himself lived in Jerusalem 20 years. He writes, I have received a tradition to the effect that the body of Adam, the first man, was buried upon the spot where Messiah was crucified. And Origen said Christ was crucified, etc. This tradition was afterward referred to by Athanasius, Epiphanius, okay, Basil of Caesarea, Chrysostom, and other later writers. These are all Christian teachers all through the years. The tomb and skull of Adam, still pointed out in an excavated chamber below the traditional Calvary, marks the survival of this tradition on the spot. This is by far the most ancient explanation of the name Golgotha, and in spite of the absurdity of the original tradition about Adam, it's probably the true one. Okay, so whether or not, that's the end of my quotes now, whether or not the tradition is true, it is very possible that Yeshua was actually crucified on the Mount of Olives, not very far from where he was taken by the temple guard the night before. Please notice in John chapter 19 that Pilate washed his hands of the whole business and told the Sanhedrin, you have a guard, the same guard that had arrested Yeshua the night before. You see to it. And they did, breaking the Torah of Yah. There had to be at least two eyewitnesses to a capital offense, and the Sanhedrin had none. All of that to show that the Sanhedrin of Yeshua's day was no more upright than the Sanhedrin of Yechezkel's day. There truly is nothing new under the sun. That's what I got through verse 16.
They're kind of like the modern-day version of a, well, let's just say, just about anything that we see going on in the swamp when it comes to, you name it, right? Have we seen lawlessness abound? Yeah, it's kind of hard to argue against that.
Yes, it is. You got something for us, Ken?
Yeah. Well, firstly, let me expound a little bit upon what you were just saying, MP, about the second tradition of possibly Adam or Adam being buried on.
Yeah.
On the Golgotha, on that mound, in which I heard the same thing, and I also heard, related to that, was that the city of Yerushalayim very well could have been, seriously, in way back in that day, the Garden of Eden.
Oh, I believe that the Temple Mount was in the middle of the garden, my own personal opinion.
And, right. And possibly that when he was kicked out of the garden, he would not have ventured far at all from the gate, you know, where the two cherubim were located, you know. And that very well could have been in the Kidron Valley, which means that the very first altar that Adam would have put up may have been the same one that was there. You know, which that was where the red heifer sacrifice also took place across the Kidron Valley on that altar. So it almost makes sense that that would, you know, fit for a lot of things, including Adam being, you know, a place where he put his altar when he had to leave the Garden of Eden. So, yeah, I wanted to put out that out there first. Also, I wanted to mention, because I know we're speaking a lot about truths that Christianity has probably a hard time swallowing. one place where I went to years ago, and since I was actually buying books by the tens anyway, and then giving them out to people who love to discuss such things, was a book called Fossilized Customs by Lou White. Very good book, and gives lots of detail about all the different, you know, pagan traditions and how they got merged in, usually, no thanks to the Emperor Constantine, you know, back in the 300s or so.
Right.
A lot of that stuff got mixed in, you know. But there is a lot of good truths in that book that I just love to read. It's a very interesting book, so I do recommend it to those out there
who
might want to know a little bit more.
Customs by Lou White, correct?
Yes, Fossilized Customs by Lou White.
Go
ahead, MC.
Like, It's a little bit like drinking from a fire hose. He provides lots of information. Honestly, it's a bit poorly True. Organized. If you go back and you say, oh, I know I saw this in the book somewhere. Where is that? You'll have a heck of a time finding it again. And you'll end up, because it's kind of a stream of consciousness almost. But you're right. There's a lot of folks that have read the book and have recognized, and I think many of them probably listeners here, yeah, that's where I first heard about all of this paganism. So what he does is, essentially, take the things we're talking about here, Tammuz and Semiramis and bunnies and eggs and Christmas trees and Yule logs and all of this pagan crap, and make sure that you can understand where it comes from in the wonderful whore church traditions and how it was Christianized and how it's, in fact, an abomination to Yah.
Right.
Absolutely. Now, let me comment a little bit again on verses like 13 through 16. Now, I feel that each turn that Yah has Ezekiel make, the more shocking and nearly unbelievable, at least in my mind, the abominations are. And Ezekiel was shown, for example, in verse 14, you see women on the north side of the temple weeping for one of their gods, Tammuz. So here you have women, okay, on one side. Then in verse 16, between the temple and the altar. I mean, think about that. You know, this is total abomination. Here right. You find men worshiping the sun. Yeah. I mean, can it get any worse? So you have women on one side.
To go from where he's offering or where he's at to where he's going to present the offering, he's got to go through that pagan thing. It's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. And that's what they're doing right here in this chapter.
Yeah, and this is their new ordinances, okay? This is not Yah's ordinances. That's for darn sure.
That's right.
No, they got their own thing going on here. Now, you know, such great sin was done in Yah's house. This is the terribleness of it all, okay? Worshipping their gods in his house. I want to remind us of Yah's words that should have rung in the ears and the minds of all these people. Okay. Think about in Vayikra or Leviticus 18 verses 3-5. Now this is probably my favorite chapter in all of Vayikra because it is very simple to understand ordinances, statutes, and judgments that are good for us today. I mean, please, we need to read them and adhere to them. But in verses 3-5, it's written, after the doings of the land of Egypt or Mitzrayim, wherein you dwelt. Now, by the way, think of us today. Okay. This is when you left your sinful nature. Okay. That's the land of Mitzrayim for you and I.
Okay, where or we you could say the swamp nowadays.
Shall
too.
Ye? That's right. Absolutely. Shall ye not do? And after the doings of the land of Canaan, where I bring you, shall ye not do? Now, aren't we all in the land of Canaan today? I mean, what's going on around us? It's all wickedness. It says, neither shall you walk in their ordinances. Ye shall do my judgments and keep mine ordinances to walk therein, because Amen. I am Yahuwah your Elohim. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments. Now think about these words, which if a man do, he shall live in them. There is the key. Now, I know the key is the following words, I am Yahuwah. Okay. But yeah, if you do these things, you shall live by doing these things. I know it says live in them, but yeah, you will walk in these statutes, ordinances, and judgments. But guess what? You live. There's the key word. You live then. But if you don't, you will not live. That's how I see it. Think about what he said in Deuteronomy, or Deuteronomy 7:16, where it's written, and thou shalt consume all the people which Yahuwah the Elohim shall deliver thee. Thine eyes shall have no pity upon them, neither shall thou serve their gods, for that will be a snare unto thee. Boy, ding, ding. Again, right. Deuteronomy 18, verse 9. When thou art come into the land which Yehuah thy Elohim giveth thee, which, by the way, is where they are, thou shalt not learn to do after the abominations of those nations. Wow, here they are doing that exact thing. And then lastly, even in this similar day, probably, by Yirmiyahu, 25 verse 6, this went out to his people also, and go not after other gods to serve them and to worship them, and provoke me not to anger with the works of your hands, and I will do you no hurt or harm. I mean, think about all these times he reaches out and makes it simple and plain. You know, do as I have shown you. Otherwise, you will not live. There will be no eternity for you. That's really what he's saying.
Well, wait a second. There may be no next day, and that's where we're going next. That's a good note, Ken, but let's pick it up and read on, because the point you're making, he is going to demonstrate to them, literally, at the point of death. So, I want to do one more. I want to do one more thing. Sorry, before we get there, because they have filled the land with Hamas with violence. We know that word, and they have returned, made teshuvah, to provoke me to anger. So they turned in the wrong direction. Therefore, I am not going to pity them. I'm going to act in fury. But before he says that, he says this: indeed, they put the branch to the nose. Now, I don't want to dwell on this too much, because one thing is clear. We don't necessarily know what it is. You do a web search on it, you're going to find lots of stuff. A lot of the sages say, well, we don't know what this is. It's lost in antiquity. Some of them will admit maybe the reason it's lost in antiquity is because it hits too close to home, and so we've expunged that. But there is a reference to thumbing the nose. Maybe not quite so much. But in fact, it references a branch or a stick, referring to the Persian custom, says one reference here, of worshiping the rising sun. Now, that fits. By holding in their left hand a bundle of twigs of a plant called Barsam. We're not quite sure what that is. Might be pomegranate, might be tamarisk, might be myrtle. But in any case, I did like one summary that I saw from an individual who just wrote, hey, one thing is really clear. You cannot deny that without question, this is a pagan practice. It certainly has to do with sun god worship and a lot of things that are abomination. And any way you slice it, the context is undeniable. He hates it. And it's all the kinds of stuff that they were doing and claiming was, worship to him. At least now, back then, they were hiding it because they couldn't make the claim. Go ahead.
I'm in.
Yeah, go ahead, MP.
Okay. Well, then let me hit on chat verses 17 and 18. Azamra has this on 16 through 18. They said, and he brought me to the inner court, and behold, about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of Hashem and their faces toward the east, and they were prostrating themselves towards the sun. Now, you've heard me say that what they're doing here is they have their backs turned to the presence of Yah. They're kneeling. They're bowing as they're kneeling, and they're sticking their butts up in the air, and they're showing their backsides to Yah. Okay, this is as wicked a thing as you could possibly do. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, you're sticking your butt right in his face. Say, here, smell this. That's what they're saying. So, as if this is in itself is not offensive enough, Rashi and Metsudas David, commenting on the phrase, rendered it as they put the branch, Mezorah, to the nose in verse 17. They write that the people were crudely breaking wind from behind, creating a kind of vibrating song, as it were, the root of Zemer, and that the prophet is saying that the foul smell would simply come into their own nostrils. In other words, their shame would abound in their own faces. Now, may Hashem deliver us from all such abominations and deliver us to true, pure service to God. That is what I got from Azamra on that. Stone Stanak has this on verse 17. The scent of the incense is referred to as derogatorily as the foul odor of expelled flatulence. In deference to God's honor, the odor is described as going into their nose rather than into God's nose. But that's what they're doing. They're sticking their butts in God's face. and they're releasing noxious fumes. That's what the idea is. TSK has this on They Put. So the Vulgate has, they apply the branch to their nose, which Jerome explains by the branch of the palm tree with which they adored the idols. And it seems plainly to allude to the Magian fire worshippers who, Strabo tells us, held a little bunch of twigs in their hand when praying before the fire. Adam Clark commentary on this. This is an old-time guy. This is supposed to mean some branch or branches which they carried in succession on in honor, rather, of the idol, and with which they covered their faces, from which they inhaled a pleasant smell, the branches being odoriferous. That's what Adam Clark writes. That the heathen carried branches of trees in their sacred ceremonies is well known to persons acquainted with classical antiquity. And it is probable that the heathen borrowed those from the use of such branches in the worship on the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles. There are many strange and some filthy interpretations given to this clause, but the former is not worth repeating, and I abominate the latter so much to submit to defile my paper with them. That's Adam Clark says, I'm not even going to write about this. It's so bad. Probably the Brahmin lingua is here intended. And when you say Brahmin, you're talking about Indian religion. Now, it really seems that at this time the Jews had incorporated every species of idolatry in their impure worship. Phoenician, Egyptian, and Persian. Everybody around them, they're acting like their neighbors, okay, rather than the way Yah told them to. I like Azamra's explanation better than the others, but they do have some merit. I mean, the Adam Clark, the TSK, Stones to Knock, they all have merit, but the Azamra was absolutely the best. Anyway, verse 18 has Yah telling Ezekiel that he is furious and will deal with the abject idolatry of the priests with fury. I can only imagine what that would look like.
Oh, we're going to find out.
He will spare nothing in his fury. You want to say something, Mark?
No, I just said we're getting ready to find out, MP.
Okay.
Ken has a comment before you move on, though. Go ahead and let him in.
Go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to give my take on the put the branch to their nose, because you were just commenting on that, MP.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, one outlook that I personally have is because the word put is the word shalak, which means to put away,
right.
Okay, to send away or put away, and the branch being like a vine, you know, the nose being nostrils, as in remember when Yah created Adam and Hawa, he breathed into his nose or nostrils, same word. So to me, the branch unto the nose or nostrils for life, I believe it's a picture of how we should be, but they put that away. They sent it away. That's how I think this could also mean is that they literally said, nope, we're not going to, be brought to life through the vine that we should be a part of, you know, and they literally put it away. So anyway, I just wanted to break in for that. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, again, cool. One thing is clear, that it's noxious. He doesn't like it. And it's, in context, certainly sounds like something that represents a whole lot of the other abominations we're seeing here. All right. From here, what I want to do, and we can certainly come back. We're going to want to go back and look at some of these greater abominations because it fits. But this next chapter tells us, you know, like MP kept saying, we'll see what it's like. Well, he's going to tell us what it's like. Then it says, he called out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, let those who have charge over the city draw near, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. And, okay, we got less than a minute, Ken. Go ahead. He's got to come in on chapter 8.
Just a quick comment, because what I see here at the end is more and more Yah is allowing this fullness of wickedness. Remember, Yah does this a lot. You know, he does not often make a move until a fullness comes to fruition. And I believe this is yet again a good example where he allowed his people even to come to a fullness of wickedness to where he would then cut them off. And this is when, and this is being shown that they're being cut off at this point. So yeah, I just wanted to comment on that. Go ahead, MP.
Okay. In verse 18, Yah's telling Zeke that he is furious and will deal with the abject idolatry of the priests with fury. I can only imagine what that would look like.
Times I lay.
Okay, we're going to find out. We don't have to imagine. Here it comes right after the break.
I'm breathing, and I pray, don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my fears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So my negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord turns around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more, and our children will pay. Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old. It's not new. Challenge it in motion.
All right, we are back, folks. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable to Knock edition. Last segment for today, and I know we won't finish Chapter 9. There's lots and lots of important stuff in here, so we'll come back, and don't worry. I know that MP thinks that there's more we want to talk about on Chapter 8, and it will fold back in here, because one of the things that he said more than once was, gee, I can only imagine how Yah is going to feel about this, what he's going to do, and the answer is no. We don't have to imagine. He's going to tell us, and let me read these first few verses, then I'll go back to MP. But the prophet says, he called out in a loud voice in my hearing, saying, let those who have charge over the city draw near, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. And suddenly, it says, six men. Suddenly is always an interesting word in the Bible. They came from the direction of the upper gate, facing north, each with a battle axe in his hand. One man among them was clothed in linen with a writer's inkhorn at his side. Now, I call this the Malak, the messenger, the angel with the inkhorn series and story. And I think if you're looking for an understanding of how Yah feels about paganism in his holy places, you're not going to find a better example. Here we go. So one of them had a writer's inkhorn. They went in, they stood beside the bronze altar. Now, the glory of Yahuwah of Israel, the Elohim of Israel, had gone up from the cherub. Where it had been, to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed with linen, who had that writer's inkhorn at his side, and he says the following. So listen carefully. This is going to set everything up. And again, I can only imagine, well, he's going to tell us. Yahuwah said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark. Now, by the way, this is not the mark of the beast. This is his mark. On the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done with it. Now, another quick comment from me on this one. This is part of the reason why I suggest that when it comes to seeing these abominations, folks, we are not to keep silent. We are supposed to do exactly what it is that these people are being marked for doing, and as it turned out, they're going to be slain for not doing. Sighing and crying at the abominations that are being done, whether it's in Jerusalem or the even greater check out here, check out there abominations that we're seeing now all over a land that once honored him, but now has kicked him out of literally every place. Put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry. Then the others, he said, in my hearing, go after him throughout the city and kill. Do not let your eye spare, nor have any pity. Now listen to this, and this is, to my mind, kind of the culmination of all of this. We're going to see how these pieces fit together right here. This is in his hearing. The prophet hears this. The creator and the author of scripture and the one who's given the orders here says, utterly slay old and young, men, maidens, little children, and women. but do not come near anyone on whom is the mark, basically my mark. Oh, yeah, and begin at my sanctuary. So they began,
right.
What did they begin doing? Yeah, slaying, marking and then slaying the elders who were before the temple. Let's pause right there, and we'll go to MP.
I'm in. Well, I'll cover the first couple of verses and then give it over to Ken. It sure looks at the opening sentence, or by the opening sentence, rather, that chapter 9 is a continuation of chapter 8, doesn't it?
You bet.
Stone Stonach says, Ezekiel heard as God summoned the forces that were to destroy the city. Okay, the destroying weapon is the Hebrew 4892, Masheto, from the Hebrew 7843, Shachat. To corrupt or to denigrate irreversibly. Azamra has this to open the chapter. And he cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, in verse 1, in the last verse of the previous chapter, from which the present verse follows with no section break in the Hebrew text, by the way, God had said that he would have no mercy on the people of Jerusalem because of their sins, and though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them, in Ezekiel chapter 8 and verse 18. The opening verse of the present chapter directly echoes this verse, and now God cries out with a loud voice, ordering those that have charge of the city to draw close with their weapons of destruction in their hands. That's in verse 1 of our present chapter. Here's me. Yah is not talking to the men of the city, but to the men who are conquering the city, to come forward with their destroying weapons. They are not only going to take over the city, but are bringing weapons of destruction to break down the walls of the city and the temple of Shlomo. Okay? The Babylonians are coming, and they're going to tear it all down. KJV, and they're the guys that are going to do the Yah's work, okay, more than anything. KJV verse 2 gives me the impression that the six men may actually be angels to guide the hands of the conquerors. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Stone Stonach has this note on verse 2. The man clothed in linen is the angel Gabriel, who in Yehezkel's vision was to cast fire upon Jerusalem. From his loins hung scribal instruments, represented by the slate, with which to inscribe on the foreheads of the righteous the mark that would spare them from death, that according to Radak. Now, if the one with the writer's inkhorn is Gabriel, and six with slaughter weapons had to be angels of Gabriel's host, remember, there are three hosts created. There were three hosts created in Genesis, whose generals were Gabriel, Michael, and the adversary. Okay? Hasatan. I think he was called Lucifer at the time. And here's Azamra on verse 2. Ezekiel, who in his prophetic vision was standing in the temple courtyard, now saw six men coming by way of the upper gate, verse 2, together with a seventh, wearing linen with a scribe's equipment on his side, or at his side. Radak states that according to the plain meaning of the text, Yehezkel prophetically saw the ministers of Nebuchadnezzar, who were to enter Jerusalem when the city walls were breached, 6 years after this prophecy. In Jeremiah 39:3, see Radak on verse 2 of our present chapter. That's what Azamra says. On the level of Darash, the sages of the Talmud stated that the first six men were destructive angels. Ketzef, Af, Chema, Mashkis, Mesheber, and Machela. That is, rage, anger, fury, spoiler, smasher, and destroyer. While the king's scribe, dressed in linen, who later cast fire upon the city, was the angel Gabriel. That according to Shabbos 55a, and Rashi and Radak. Now, the brazen altar, by the side of which they stood to receive their orders, was the name given to King Shlomo's stone altar, which replaced the brazen altar for animal offerings that Moshe had made for the sanctuary in the wilderness. The stone altar stood in the Azara, the main temple courtyard, as opposed to the golden incense altar, which stood inside the temple sanctuary, in between the menorah and the showbread table. If that is all true, and this is me talking now, when the six hosts of Yah's angels may have been six generals, archangels, for lack of a better term, each of whom have armies under their commands. If that is the case, Yerushalayim is toast. As if we didn't already know, having read ahead once or twice. When they came into the sanctuary, they took their places alongside the brazen altar, which would be the one in the center of the sanctuary and was the main focus of chapter 8, at the focal point of the four gates of the temple proper. Okay? That's what I got on verses 1 and 2, and we'll be seeing all that other stuff when we get to it in verses 3 and following. Anyway, that's what I got through verses 1 and 2.
Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, firstly, let me say on verse 1 that this, I believe, is one of those instances where Yah speaks a thing into existence and does so before the prophet so that the prophet sees and hears and eventually records it. And in this case, it's as if Yah is full of emotion so that even he cries out loud. Again, I think he performs this act this way to ensure Ezekiel understands his desire and effort. And of course, this extends to those six men who respond immediately. Because remember, he cries this out. It's a loud voice. And immediately you have these, it says, behold, these six men are there. Bam. You know, it was immediate the way I see it. Now, I can't help but recall how Yah and Moshe used the Levites to slaughter the wicked in these verses in Shemot or Exodus chapter 32 when they were found to have partook in the creation and celebration of the golden calf. And let me read these three verses, verses 26 through 28 of Shemot or Exodus, where it's written, then Moshe stood in the gate of the camp and said, who is on Yahuwah's side? Let him come unto me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together unto him. And he said unto them, thus saith Yahuwah Elohim of Israel, put every man his sword by his side and go in and out from gate to gate throughout the camp and slay every man his brother and every man his companion and every man his neighbor. And the children of Levi did according to the word of Moshe. And there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men.
That's right.
Now, of course, Moshe had an entire tribe instead of just six men to do the work needed. But do note that in both cases, it's the righteous who do the work of removing the wicked or leaven from amongst the camp or his people, you know. And now another thematic connection to consider is the marking of his people or those walking uprightly, okay, likened to those who were being marked and thus saved from death. Recall the forehead marking of our first high priest, Aaron. This mark upon Aaron was engraved, and by the way, also wore linen during his duties, remember?
Right.
It's likened to one of the six men here chosen by Yah that were wearing linen and had ink upon him to write. Now here is Aaron's case. This is in Shemot or Exodus 28, verses 36 through 39, where it's written, and thou shalt make a plate of pure gold engrave upon it, like the engravings of a signet, holiness to Yahuwah. And thus thou shalt put it on a blue lace, that it may be upon the mitre, upon the forefront of the mitre it shall be, and it shall be upon Aaron's forehead. that Aaron may bear the iniquity of the holy things, which the children of Israel shall hallow in their holy gifts, and it shall be always upon his forehead, that they may be accepted before Yahuwah. And thou shalt embroider the coat of fine linen, and thou shalt make the mitre of fine linen, and thou shalt make the girdle of needlework. So note that it was the writing upon his forehead.
That's right.
Holiness to Yahuwah that was provided as an acceptance before our Creator. Now this will be the same for all those marked in Ezekiel chapter 9, right? They will be accepted before Yahuwah, whereas all others in this case, in Ezekiel chapter 9, will be brought to death. Now, I do believe that the men, those that were marked, I believe, would be responsible for their wives and their unmarried, as in children, in their household, as the event of Pesach was in Shemot chapter 12, if you recall, in which the mark of the blood upon the doorpost provided such continued life among the firstborn. Remember that. Because this is the way Yah is. We need to gather all of the details about how Yah is and what he does.
Very good.
And of course, we can also see again and yet again that Yah always removes the wicked from amongst his people. Even considering, and I do hate to jump ahead, but I'm just going to jump two verses on just one little comment here. Even considering the words in verse 8 where it states that Ezekiel remained, I love those words. You'll see it time and time again, even where often it's mentioned by Christian pastors, because I've heard this time and time again, that, oh, these verses show how, we are lifted up before as a rapture, you know. We're taken away before the wicked are condemned, etc. But actually, when you read the words, like, for example, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, you're going to find out this word remained, where his people remain, because that's what happens. His people are the ones who remain. And as with other instances throughout Scripture.
His people are left behind, is another way to put it.
Say that again.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
His people are left behind. And if you go read through the way Yeshua phrases it in Matthew chapter 24, he says two women are grinding at the well, two men out in the field, and one of them's taken, the other is basically left behind. And guess what? Then he goes on to talk about how Noah, and they were doing this, and then the flood came and did what? Took them all away, and guess who was left behind? The point is, the books, the lies are wrong. You don't want to be taken away. You want to be left behind, because the ones that are left are the good ones that get protected. And here we're going to see it again in this chapter.
Amen.
The bad ones are getting taken away.
Yes, amen.
Absolutely right. The kingdom of Messiah on earth, Revelation chapter 20 and following, okay, that is all the people that live into it are those who are redeemed, and everyone else is taken out, okay? And there are people who are children of the redeemed who are not redeemed. And they will not go into the kingdom in chapter 21 and 22. Okay? And that is where we're going to see absolute righteousness everywhere. Okay? That book of Revelation is absolutely amazing. Beginning in chapter 19, it tells you that the believers go into the kingdom. Okay? And they had children, and some of their children are not believers, and they are wiped out in the lake of fire. It's just, I mean, it's just, it's absolutely clear if you think about it and don't follow after other people's teaching. Anyway, that's...
And by the way, two more examples. One I mentioned, which was Pesach. Remember, the firstborn of the wicked were removed from amongst the good firstborn. You know? In other words, and also consider Zechariah 14, What's the first thing that happens when Yahushua, our Messiah's feet, land upon the earth? Is that he begins to slaughter.
Yeah.
It's not like he touches down and grabs all of his people and says, "Oh, come on up to the air with me. Let's hurry up and get up to the air before, you know." No, he first touches down and then he begins to slaughter. And then you read about how later, you know, his people remain and they go on to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Yeah, there you go. Right. It all ties in together. Hallelujah. And as with many other instances throughout Scripture, such cleansing begins with people and places that were most near to him, to Yah.
All right.
That's the way he works.
And so
he reaches out to his places and his people first. Go ahead, MC.
All right. We've got about 4 minutes, not even, left today. And I just want to close with a question. And I know we'll have to pick it up and we'll talk about some more of this next time. The chapter before basically just has finished describing, look over here, look over there, see all the abominations. We got sunrise services. We got Lent. We got Ishtar. We got bunnies and eggs. We've literally got all kinds of crap. And I keep using that word that is an abomination unto him, to the point where he says, here's what I want you to do. Going to send these six men out, going to send this angel with the inkhorn. He's going to mark those who sigh and cry at these abominations. Everybody else going to get whacked. And then he says the following: kill them all, man, woman, and children. Do not spare. Do not let your eye pity. Utterly slay young and old, men, maidens, little children, but not anyone on whom's a mark. Oh, yeah. And here it is. And begin at my sanctuary. Now, what we hear now in the whore church are a couple of things. Oh, the temple is gone because God didn't like what the Jews were doing there. Well, arguably, that's true. So it's not been replaced with the Roman whore church and with the thing that's in my heart. I don't need Torah anymore. It's written in my heart. He dwells in my heart. Begin at my sanctuary. I'm going to ask a question. I'll go to UMP first. Just a quick answer. I know it's going to be one we're going to come back to. Is the place where he begins today, is the sanctuary, has it got anything to do with the Roman or the pagan church? Or is that moved so far from his sanctuary that begin at my sanctuary no longer has any meaning? Or are people rightfully concerned if they say, if he was to repeat this, and certainly history looks like it's repeating, maybe the sanctuary that is a pagan sanctuary now is not a good place to be. Go ahead.
You've said it all. You've said it all. You're absolutely correct. The mainstream Christianity is lamestream Christianity. I mean, they haven't got the slightest. We still have to go after Torah. Absolutely, we gotta follow it. We have to, because that's Yah's word to us. Go ahead, Ken. You got your meme up. Take it away.
I just wanted to give my thought on that question.
Please.
Because I really see all of this as a reminder to us, not just of the physical, but of the spiritual, that this is truly all about us within our hearts, because we are that sanctuary. We are what we should have built within us, such a sanctuary. And those who have not built a sanctuary within them, what are they doing? They're doing just like what happened here. They think they're hiding it. They think, oh, that Yah isn't a real Yah. I don't even believe that. I'm going to do whatever my heart, you know, my mind thinks is possible to their imagination, you know? So to me, when it says start in my sanctuary, he's talking about start in the hearts of man. That's where we're going to start. That's where we're going to find the truth. Go to the heart of every man, and there you will find it. There is the truth. The truth lies there. This person is either clean and has built a sanctuary for me to reside in, or this one is wicked, and that sanctuary is destroyed. It is defiled. So put it down, just like he's been showing here. Put it all down, you know? That's how I see it. It's one or the other. It's all about the heart of man.
Exactly right.
So
Well, and remember what Jeremiah said.
Answer the question. See?
Yeah, I agree. And we got to go back to Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu. I mentioned this earlier where he says, I believe it's 16:19, where he says, the heart of man, it's deceitful above all and desperately wicked. Who can know it? So there literally is, I think, a caution there when people talk about, oh, he knows my heart. And the answer is yes, and that there is judgment at hand, and we do have to be very concerned when we read things like this. And, that's the Old Testament God. He doesn't do that anymore. We got a nice, warm, fuzzier Jesus who actually, it turns out, didn't change a single yoder tittle.
Not true.
Yeah. So lots to be aware of. We're going to do
greasy grace.
We're going to leave it there, and we'll pick it up next week right here, probably with this section, The Angel with the Inkhorn, what it means and why it's important, especially today. Thanks, guys. Shalom, folks.